podcast where we talk to creative writing MFA students about their program, their process, and a piece they're working on. I'm your host, Jared McCormick. Today I'm with Dana Liebelson. Dana grew up in Bozeman, Montana, and is now an MFA candidate in creative writing at the University of Wyoming. She attended the 2020 Tin House Summer Workshop, and she is represented by Sarah Manning of the Bent Agency. Her journalism has appeared in The Atlantic, Insider, Elle.com, Mother Jones, and HuffPost, and is the recipient of a Writers Guild Award. Today, Dana is going to read a piece of her flash fiction that was recently published in Cheap Pop, titled She Probably Didn't Mean It.
You often go to the dinosaur museum to avoid your mother. You eat edibles and sit in the planetarium and watch the Pink Floyd laser show. You touch the bronze bones of Big Mike. You lick golden lollipops from the gift shop with preserved mealworms. You dance the scroll of deep time, humanity reduced to a sliver of paper on the wall. Deep time makes you dizzy, like the first time you realized your mother would die. During Titanic, the part where the Irish woman puts her children to bed before they drown, you were 9. In the museum, there is a small dark room where the curators play boring black and white films of scientific experiments. This is your favorite room. If you cry, no one else is ever in here to ask why your sad breath smells of insects. Ernst Chladni was a German contributor to the field of meteoritics, says today's boring film. He collected reports of rocks dropping from the sky, and in 1794 published a book theorizing that they come from space, according to meteoritics and planetary science. At the time, he was dismissed for grounding his evidence in stories considered to be folk tales, the journal reported. You wonder aloud, stoned, how do you prove a fireball that only burns in your mother's memory? The narrator does not answer your question. Chladni is also credited with this experiment, where he put sand on a plate and drew a bow across the plate, causing the sand to leap into patterns, the narrator continues. Through the speakers, the hair of the violin bow whispers like the devil, but the trembling designs look to you like maps drawn by someone's god. There's something wrong with you, your mother said. The words play in your head like a car stereo thumping in the distance. You see the vibrations of your mother's voice shifting sand into shapes. There's something wrong with you. The shape of her frozen red mouth, smiling even when she is angry. The shape of good enough, a resonance not reached. The shape of her white cowboy boots, which you are wearing now to be more beautiful. There's something wrong with you. In deep time, femurs last longer than words, and you never feel alone at the dinosaur museum. You stand and smooth your frayed jean skirt. As you leave for home, you imagine tipping over Chladni's plate, the magical pattern falling through your fingers. It's just sand.
Dana, thanks for reading that, and thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That piece was very recently published in Cheap Pop, so first off, congratulations.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's exciting. I was struck when I was reading it by like the mystery of it, the mystery of like our place in the cosmos alongside the mystery of our place in our own families or even in our own bodies. So there are several references to storytelling in this story, from the folk tales the scientist uses as evidence to prove meteorites, to how Titanic made the narrator confront her own mortality and her mom's mortality. And the references to femurs lasting longer than words. So what role do you think storytelling plays in understanding ourselves and the world that we live in?
Yeah, it's interesting you brought that up, because the seed of the story came from what was called a narrative of science class. So thinking about storytelling within science, taught by the awesome Frida Knobloch. So, you know, at the time, I'm a very research-based writer in that I tend to start from life and then move into the realm of fiction or storytelling through revision. So with this particular story, it kind of came from the dinosaur museum I used to go to growing up in Bozeman as a kid, the Rocky Mountain Dinosaur Museum. And then in this narratives of science class, we had watched a video of Chladni's plates, and I kind of fell down a rabbit hole researching Chladni. So in terms of like storytelling, I think I start with different images, and then from somewhere through a vision, those things kind of conglomerate together into storytelling. I don't think I answered your question though.
That's okay. That was super interesting. And Yeah, that makes me feel good. It makes me feel like my reading was like pretty good on this, because I wasn't sure.
Yes.
I wasn't sure. I mean, to me, it seems like you're arguing in the story that both science and storytelling plays a role in like understanding our place in this world and understanding life in general. Is that kind of what you were going for?
Yeah, I mean, I maybe have a more dismal view of it. I think particularly being in Wyoming, maybe it's hard to just like not think about extinction right now. So in terms of maybe it's a little bit like it's like wishful thinking, putting myself in the narrative of science when in reality, like if you look at deep time, where this tiny little fingernail is, I think the way they describe it. So it's like I feel this need to get as many stories out as possible during this like tiny time when we get to like be around as a species, which feels increasingly shorter lately, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it does. Well, I mean, I find it even more fascinating when I think about like your background and your career as a journalist when you were devoted to facts and then now moving into fiction where you're devoted in a sense to making things up. So is that dichotomy in yourself something that you think about a lot or that tends to come out in your work?
Yeah, I do think about that a lot. I would say it's probably one of like the fundamental questions I'm exploring in my novel project right now. In some ways, I feel like being in journalism requires a certain level of arrogance to go in and be like, I'm going to tell the narrative of what happened based on my interviews with all of these people. And that's a really important job, but it's also a kind of arrogant one, I think, in some ways. And it raises a lot of questions about who from which community gets to tell a story. Should it be me as the journalist, or should it be the community itself telling their own stories? Right. So I think that's something I've had some conflict about personally, you know, over the last few years. So with fiction, it's kind of my opportunity to tell a story with a little bit less pressure in terms of accurately conveying another community's story. I can just kind of tell the story I want to tell selfishly. So maybe it's sort of easier to me in that respect.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've tried to write both creative nonfiction and fiction. My focus is in fiction, and I find nonfiction to be incredibly difficult, even when telling stories about my own life, to like having this responsibility to get everything right. I love how fiction gives us the chance to tell those stories in some respect, but like fill in the blanks, you know, how we want. I do think there's like some hopefulness to this story. I mean, at the end, the narrator like tips, like imagining tipping over the plate of sand, left me with like this really rich feeling that the character was kind of coming to terms and embracing the fact that she was different and maybe that she had some control over her destiny in some way. So what are you hoping that readers get when they read that story?
I hope if we're all stuck inside with COVID right now, arguing with people, you take a minute and take a step back and be like, you know what? It's not that big of a deal. I'm just going to let it go.
Yeah.
That's the way I kind of view that ending. But I think anything is valid.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do love that. I mean, it's a mind blowing idea, just deep time and just how long the earth and the universe has been around compared to this tiny sliver that we've been here. So it does give you some like perspective, I think, when you're dealing with issues in your own life. You really get a sense when reading the story of like that spectrum of life and its mysteries and that like large scale exploration of deep time and the small scale exploration of the narrator, like realizing her mother will die and like everything in between, the dinosaurs, the meteorite that killed the dinosaurs. You're from Montana and now you're living in Wyoming. I can imagine that the grandeur of those landscapes could make one ponder their place in the world. How has living and growing up in the West affected your worldview and your writing?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think people, you know, project a lot onto Western landscapes, you know, land that doesn't originally belonged to me and has a long history of violent displacement of indigenous people. So I think I feel politically reluctant to like glorify the landscape in any way in my writing. At the same time, like I grew up in the mountains, probably about 10-minute drive from downtown Bozeman, with like not any close neighbors, a few neighbors, but not super close. And I think the isolation of that experience tends to seep into my work. So I think where people think of like grandeur with the West, for me, a lot of it is about feeling isolated and far away from other people, which is maybe not a surprise then that I moved to a city when I was 17. But now I'm sort of back to kind of like, you know, I'm also attracted to it in some ways. It's a good space to write. But yeah, I think I'm a little conflicted in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also mentioned to me that since you started at the University of Wyoming, your writing has become increasingly strange and experimental. So why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying this happens to like everybody who comes here, but there's like different paths you can go down. And also like Joy Williams is here. So I've been reading a lot of Joy's work and that's obviously influential. I think it's probably some combination of the reading that I've been doing and wanting to always head down that path. Lately I've been reading a lot of Sewald. I'm reading Correction by Thomas Bernhard, which I talk about every time I'm drinking because it's so weird. And I want everyone else to talk to me about it. I've been reading The Childhood of Jesus by Coetzee. So I think I'm just kind of attracted to that space with my reading right now. And it's probably influencing my writing as well.
Well, you also told me that you're interested in how people apply narratives to the West. And as a person who identifies as Jewish, you said you're particularly interested in non-traditional narratives. I know you've been working on a novel while in the program. Are those themes that you're exploring in that novel?
I'm kind of like reluctant. I don't even know what my themes are right now. Like I really can't figure that out. But yeah, I would say maybe because I grew up in Montana, I don't necessarily glamorize the place in the same way. I think Montana is kind of seen as this escapist place from like rising rents in cities and all this other stuff right now. And I don't necessarily like agree with that mentality. So I think that's definitely like influencing my work somewhat. In terms of like non-traditional narratives, yeah, I'm interested in all kinds of non-traditional narratives about the West. And I think a lot of other writers here are as well, and professors. Whether it's growing up identifying as Jewish or something totally unrelated, I sort of have thought of myself as a bit of an outsider in terms of what we think of with the traditional Western narrative. So what I like to do is kind of like take places in the West that feel familiar, but then like build my own strangeness on top of it, whether it's like Bucky's gas station in Austin or like someplace I went hiking in Wyoming. Yeah. So maybe I am actually projecting my own narratives onto things, which is problematic, but I think we all do that a little bit.
Right, right. Yeah. And it's interesting you talk about not really knowing the themes of the novel that you're working on. Do you find that theme is something you avoid thinking about too much when you're first starting a project?
Yes. I think it can be, if you're too wedded to themes, that can distract you from other things. And also it's something that the reader should take away, I feel like, rather than something I should be dictating to the reader, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. So tell me like about your process then. Like, I mean, are you starting with a character? Are you starting with a place? Are you starting with a setting and then just building out from there and then looking back during the revision process at like what the themes might be?
Yeah. I mean, starting this project, I knew that I wanted to like write about two sisters. Like that was what drew me to the project. And I wanted to write about sort of the way that families put people in different roles, I guess, and how those roles can be inaccurate and how they can change. So I was interested in writing a book from the perspective of a character who sees himself as like always on the outside, sort of the person holding a camera instead of the person in front of the camera, and then that switching throughout the novel. So I started with like, I wanted that, and I sort of had an idea of place. Like I wanted it to be a very place-based project, both in Montana where I grew up and also partly in Wyoming and Austin, where I was living before coming here. So I feel like, yeah, that's how I started. I'm probably more plot focused than other people are, I think to my detriment sometimes. But I had like a rough idea of plot as well. So I came in with these characters, some plot and some place, and now I'm just hoping for the best.
So when you say that you had a rough idea of plot, does that mean that you're outlining much, like in the process of writing the novel?
No, I am not an outliner whatsoever. I know that can work really well for some people. We talk a lot about like novel process, I feel like, in our workshop. For me personally, it's hard to say. I would love to say that I just like get through a draft and then go back and revise it, but I'm kind of an edit as I go drafter, which is just a terrible, hellish thing that I would wish upon anybody. I know there's some people in the program or who've gone through the program who actually just start with like a blank sheet of paper for their second draft and rewrite like what they remember of the whole draft. I'm also not like that.
Yeah.
I sort of like have my baby and just like work on it endlessly, very slowly.
Yeah. I've heard of people doing both. I've tried both as well. But it's much easier to experiment with those type of revision things when you're writing something like a flash piece or a short story. But with a novel, the idea of writing an entire novel draft and then starting over with a blank sheet of paper, like that doesn't really seem possible, does it?
I swear there's people who've done it.
Well, stronger people than me. That's for sure. Well, I want to talk a little bit about your transition from journalism to fiction. You lived and worked in Washington, D.C. for most of your 20s. Tell us a bit about your career as a journalist and your decision to pursue an MFA in fiction.
Yeah, I don't like consider myself an ex-journalist. I would like to come back and do some more. I've been freelancing a bit in the program and I'd like to do some more journalism after I graduate. I've always wanted to like pursue fiction and journalism. They've always been equal interests of mine since I was like wee. So I guess with the MFA, it was something I put off for a long time as being like, I'm not really going to do that. Like I'm going to just work and work. And that seems like it's not the right use of my time. And then I think by the time I got to my late 20s, I was like, this is something I really want to do. And I felt like it was the right time for me, both personally and professionally. So yeah, I definitely do not regret the decision to come do the MFA, especially later whatsoever. I think it's been totally great.
But it must've been a little bit scary. I mean, you said that you're still doing some journalism. So you haven't completely left it behind, but in some ways I imagine you went from solely focusing on journalism as a career to now focusing the majority of your time on the MFA. So was that scary to make that decision and make that leap?
Yeah, that's a good question. Not really. I mean, I'd always been writing fiction on the side, and I know a number of other journalists who do the same. And in DC, I was like in a little workshop group with other journalists writing fiction. So to me, it was more just like really exciting that this side hobby that I'd never had enough time for years could finally be like the main thing instead of always the second thing. Scary in terms of like, what am I going to do when I graduate? Oh yeah. Like, totally. But I don't have to think about that until May. In some ways I was also concerned it was a bit of like a selfish decision, like just like bowing out before the election and going to Wyoming and not like telling much more important stories, I think, than the stories that I'm telling right now was a little bit challenging. But yeah, that's sort of how I think about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was abroad in 2016, living in South Korea when the election happened, and I had this very very real sense of guilt that I wasn't here. So that's interesting. Have you found that you said you're still doing some freelance work? Is that freelance work related to the election?
No, I think the main story that I worked on since I got to the program was for Insider, and it was a feature like about the growth in my hometown, which had to transform quite dramatically after COVID hit. So there was a lot of like re-reporting for that story. But yeah, I'm still like on Twitter too much, but I'm pretty removed right now from politics for the first time probably in years.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to be removed these days, but yeah, I do find myself trying to limit the amount that I'm taking in. How has your writing experience as a journalist influenced your creative process as a writer of fiction? Do you think it has?
Yeah, that's a good question. I found that journalism, with maybe the exception of like long form stories, has been great for me in terms of producing ideas and kind of terrible in every other way for my fiction writing. I think with journalism, I'm always condensing ideas and kind of falling into the same sentence structure. And part of the MFA is, for me, has been trying to undo some of those journalism habits with my writing. For example, I'm really terrible at positioning bodies in space. And I think part of that is like, oh, I never really did that in my journalism. Like, I never like put people in spaces.
Right. Yeah.
In terms of like, I think journalism is really good for a work ethic. I mean, every like journalist I know is can just file stories on deadline like nobody's business. So I think the work ethic is helpful for fiction. But other than that, I feel like I'm starting from square zero. Like I'm a baby freshman when it comes to fiction.
Yeah. And the art of unlearning is a real thing, right? To try to unravel those things that have been ingrained in you over the course of so many years writing
Totally.
journalism. Yeah. I can imagine that's a process all to itself. So let's talk about the MFA program, the U University of Wyoming. It's in Laramie, Wyoming. The program is fully funded. It's a 2-year program with concentrations in fiction and nonfiction at the moment. I was looking around their website. It seems that they used to have a poetry focus, but it was suspended due to funding slash faculty issues. So I guess there's a possibility that that could come back in the future. Is that still the case?
Yeah, we do not, we do have, we don't have any poets here right now in terms of students, but if you wanted to pursue, like write poetry here, we definitely have the faculty. Like Harvey Hicks is here and he's a
Okay.
poet. So he was nominated for the National Book Award for poetry. Harvey's great. I took a workshop with him. I don't write poetry at all, but there are like, we definitely have some people in our program who write poetry as well. I'm
Okay.
just not one of them.
Okay. So, it seems like maybe there's at least a possibility that the poetry concentration could come back in the future. But either way, just looking at their website, it seems that there's a lot of opportunity for cross-genre work and experimentation. According to the website, they offer special seminars in prioritizing reading, research, and career development from the writer's point of view, and have recently offered courses in flash fiction, nonfiction, long-form manuscripts, prose meditation, book arts, and podcasting. What have been some of your favorite classes that you've taken outside of the workshops?
Yeah, so I will say first of all, cross-genre stuff is a huge thing here. There's people writing across all kinds of, like, genre has melted, I feel like. And
Yeah.
that's probably present in the piece that I read. I think I'm definitely doing some weird hybrid stuff against my better judgment. In terms of favorite classes, I mean, I came here, I'm kind of a fiction purist in that, like, I came here and I was like, I want to work on my novel and nothing will deter me. So I think my course load is probably way more boring than potentially other people who are doing more exploration. I've taken my workshops. I took that narratives of science class, which I loved. Last semester, I took a transgressive novel class where we basically read books that Joy recommended. And then we also watched some very bleak documentaries recommended by Annie Fitch, like S21, the Khmer Rouge killing machine. So yeah, I feel like to me, my focus has been on trying to like read in as many interesting places as possible to supplement workshop. And I probably haven't done a ton more outside of that, but we have people working on the radio. We have all kinds of stuff going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about the workshops then. I mean, it's a pretty small program. It seems like they accept about 8 students each year. So, how big are the workshops?
Yeah, so what I've noticed is that they're alternating between small and large cohorts. So our cohort is actually, there's 4 of us, 2 fiction and 2 nonfiction. And my colleagues are awesome and I love working with them. The ones above and below have been like 8 or 9, I think, around that number. So our workshops have been, yeah, it's pretty small. I think we've got like 6 or 7 in our fiction workshop this semester. And then I'm not sure what the nonfiction folks are doing, but it's probably about that same size.
Yeah, that's quite small, 6 or 7. So, how many times are you workshopping your own work each semester?
Yeah, I think it kind of depends. I think with, we lost Brad Watson over the summer, who's a professor here. I took his workshop last fall. I think we probably workshopped like 3 or 4 times. This semester, I'm just torturing everybody and giving them like massive chunks of my novel. So my workshop has actually, they've probably read 100 pages of my work so far, and it's like October.
Well, if they keep reading, that probably is a good sign, right?
They're a coerced audience. I don't think it's the same.
Well, you know, you mentioned the size of the cohort changing. It seems, just in case any of the listeners don't understand, like, this aspect of MFA programs, some of them really prioritize funding every single student. And so sometimes their cohort size changes depending on the amount of funding they have. And they really try not to accept people that they don't have the funding to fund. And according to the website, and correct me if I'm wrong, but according to the website, the University of Wyoming is one of those universities who tries to fund every student.
Yeah, that's correct. We're all funded.
Yeah. So according to the website, the stipend's around $12,000 a year. And in addition, students receive an extra $2,000 in the summer between the first and second year. Are those numbers still the same now?
Yeah, the stipends around that for summer funding, it kind of depends. I think I just don't know what's up with COVID. I know with my class, we were able to apply for grants and got some good grant funding. I will add to that, we actually only teach one class. So even though like our stipend is lower than other programs, I found that people have had time. Like I've done some freelancing. I know other people have done some part-time work if you want to do that in addition. Wyoming's cost of living is also quite low as well, which I think makes it a good place for the MFA.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, $12,000 to me is slightly on the low end, but really kind of right in the middle from what I've seen in MFA programs. And I was going to ask, is that usually enough money to get by in Laramie?
I don't want to like speak for everyone. I can like, as a comparison, I'm in like this cute little house right now, and which I'm splitting with my fiance, and we're paying about $880 for rent a month that we split. So it's definitely a lot lower than I was paying in Austin or DC.
Yeah, right.
I also just like don't really go out and all that stuff in the same way that you would in a city. So like my cost of living is much lower.
Right, right. Well, when you're, you know, in the middle of working on a novel during your thesis year, I imagine it's easier to avoid going out to places where you might spend money.
Yeah, and winter. Don't underestimate winter here.
That's true. How are the winters in Laramie?
They're fine. They're great. Come to Wyoming. Sunny. It's like the beach.
Have you gotten into any winter sports yet?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up skiing, so I've been skiing a bit. My partner has picked up snowboarding, so we're going to try to go a bunch this winter.
Well, I did see on the website that they suggest that students can get into curling.
Wow, I don't know any curlers. I know that people have taken horseback riding, and that's like they've taken that class. I'm allergic to horses, so that didn't work out for me, but...
Well, you mentioned that the teaching load's pretty low. It's just one class per semester. How's teaching gone for you?
Yeah, so we're actually teaching, I've been teaching composition. And then in our final semester, I will be co-teaching an advanced fiction course. But so I've done comp so far. I've really enjoyed teaching so far. I feel like the university does a really great job of prepping us for class. Like we got a big binder of what to do every day. We didn't have to follow it, but like I wasn't spending tons of time designing all of my own lesson plans from scratch. So I think I wouldn't underestimate that in terms of like how much time it saves you having good support from the university. And those are things that I didn't even like think about when I was applying. Like I didn't even think about the difference between like a 1-1 and a 2-2 course load,
right?
Or like support from the university or what I'm teaching. So I think I just kind of lucked out.
Well, I will say in my course, we have a 1-1 teaching load. So just one class in the fall, one class in the semester that we teach in the first year. But in the second and third year, it goes to 2-2. So we make more money in the second and third year, but it is a significant amount of work adding that second class this semester. Did you have any trouble establishing a writing routine around your teaching load?
Personally, no. I mean, it's so many less hours than I used to work that I feel like I just have tons of time, which isn't to say that I'm not like doing all of my good school and teaching prep, but I have enough time to write. So it doesn't feel like it's a huge squeeze. I just have to set aside some writing time in the morning and make that the priority before the other things like hit me throughout the day. So that's mm-hmm. what I try to keep to.
I was teaching high school English for a year before I started the MFA program. And I remember going from, you know, having to grade 150 essays at a time in high school to having to grade 20 at a time my first year at the MFA program. I felt like I have more time that I know what to do with.
Yeah. Which isn't to say I don't fill it, like, right? Like with tons of other interests. Right.
So we've talked about Laramie a bit, but I want to talk about it a bit more. I have to be honest, I'm a bit jealous of you. I love Kansas City, but I love the mountains more. According to the University of Wyoming website, Laramie is a small Rocky Mountain town with a nice degree of funk about it. Elevation 7,200 feet with trails and scenery in the mountains that are awesome. So have you taken advantage of that kind of space around Laramie just in your own personal life and then also as part of your writing process?
Yeah, I think so. I've been trying. I mean, we go walk around Vita Vu, which is a cool, it's like these really, I actually think they're really creepy, but they're like these big ancient rock formations that are like over a billion years old. I may have made that number up, but I think it might be accurate. We've gone to the Snowies. I think this summer I really tried to get some camping in and drive around Wyoming, which was just very cool because it's just not crowded in the way that I think of camping in Colorado or near other cities. So yeah, it's definitely influenced both my writing and I've tried to just get back in touch with nature personally. I felt very grateful for that during the pandemic that we have had so much breathing space. And I know there's plenty of other people who don't sort of have the same privilege in that way.
Right, right. So, what's the community like within the program? Do you all tend to go on like excursions together, hang out on the weekends pre-pandemic? What's it like?
Yeah, I think we're like unusually close knit, probably because we are in this strange place together. I don't want to like speak for every cohort ever, but yeah, I mean, we totally do outdoor stuff together and hang out, and we're such a, because there's only four of us in our year, like we definitely, we're like, let's go to Vita Vu and go for a walk and like before class, which we all did, just the four of us.
Yeah, great. That sounds nice.
But yeah, I think the community here has been like, I can't speak for other programs, but it seems really great here in terms of like how supportive it is. And it's just not, I don't feel isolated at all. I feel like people are really like looking out for each other.
Well, that's great because I imagine, you know, Laramie's not a huge city. So I imagine there's definitely the possibility for feeling isolated. So I'm glad that you haven't felt that way. What about the literary scene in Laramie? Is there much? I mean, are there like readings, events?
Yeah, we have this really great little bookstore here that used to be a brothel, or so I've heard, back in the day. And we used to hold readings there. Now, because of COVID, we've been doing a pretty good job with Zoom readings, but I think we're going to organize a Halloween reading in someone's yard and like Zoom it still so we don't have tons of people, but like set up some gravestones. I don't know. yeah, I mean, I feel like anytime we've done readings here, they've been like very well attended by the community. Like, it's not like you're gonna have a reading and three people will show up. It's like the only event, so like 25 people will show up. So that's been really cool.
Another thing I wanted to talk to you about, we've kind of already talked about you working on the novel. I mean, you're in like your thesis year. How is that impending thesis feeling right now? How are you feeling about the program ending in May for you?
I'm really sad. It's gone by so fast. I now understand the appeal of the three-year program. Before I was like, what? No, I'm not going to be in the MFA for that long. And now that I'm here, I wish we had another year. But yeah, I'm hoping to, my goal is to have a whole novel draft done for my thesis, which is slightly insane. we'll see how the winter goes.
Are you just putting off thinking about next year and like potential plans for after the MFA, or do you have like some idea of what you might do next?
I think we're going to move back to Austin. I'm planning a wedding. Other than that, I have no idea. I would like to like finish a draft of this thing and be proud of it. Those are my only near-term goals.
Good. Just complete focus on that. I think it's what you have to do when working on a project like that,
totally.
Especially a novel. Well, I want to ask you about you being represented. You have an agent, and I think for a lot of people in MFA programs, it's pretty rare for people in MFA programs to have an agent. I think probably there are going to be listeners who are curious just about how that happened. Like, when did you get your representation, and what was the process for finding an agent?
Yeah, so probably about maybe more. I started working on a novel a long time ago, and that went through a lot of drafts and workshop. And I basically just sent out like cold queries for that novel. Like, I feel like people think of finding an agent as like they have to come down from the sky or something, but like, yeah. I don't know, email people, write a good project. It works out. I think, I sort of had the journalist mentality being like, yeah, okay, I wrote this book. It's done. It'll get published. But like, that's not really how that works. So I actually ended up going on submission with that project and didn't sell it, which I'm very grateful for, because that sort of opened the door for me to be like, no, I want to like write something that feels like I can spend more time on it and go do the MFA. So yeah, I feel like I've had such a good experience, regardless of like the worst thing happening that could happen in terms of like, it's actually, I think, pretty common not to sell the first book you go on sub with, which I think is maybe something you don't hear a lot about. So I'm pretty open about it. so yeah, that's kind of my story.
Yeah, you're not the first writer I've talked to who has written their first novel, sent it out, gotten representation from it, but then didn't sell that novel. I think that's a pretty common experience, actually. But it's cool that you were able to like get an agent through that process. So it was just you had finished the novel and you sent out some chunks of it to various agents and just queried them?
Yeah, and I want to be grateful. Well, I'll say it's pretty different than like submitting to literary magazines, because agents, like, they've responded and like written nice things, and I'm very grateful for everyone who read my work, despite the fact that it like clearly wasn't ready. I think my biggest regret is I probably queried too soon. It totally worked out, and I'm happy with how it worked out. But yeah, be more patient than I am as a person. Would be my advice. Like, I think most writers actually don't have this problem. I think it's maybe a journalist problem. I shouldn't even throw all journalists under the bus. Maybe it's just a me problem. But I was like, okay, I'm done. It's time to query.
Yeah.
But now I feel like I have so much more self-doubt because I'm in the MFA, which isn't like the MFA's fault, but I just really want to slow down now, and I'm in no rush whatsoever.
Well, you know, just because it didn't get published before doesn't mean you can't return to it.
Yeah, I hope so. I love that book. I would love to like rewrite the whole thing someday.
Just start with a blank page.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, before we go, do you have any advice for potential MFA students? Any kind of like expectations versus the reality of being in an MFA program that you might want to share with people who are considering applying?
Yeah, I feel like I consider myself someone who does a lot of research on things, and I'm sort of shocked like how little I understood about what I was getting myself into in terms of like, you should know if you're teaching comp or creative writing, you should, and what's a good fit for you. You should know how many courses you're going to teach. You should like read the work from the faculty that teach at your program. I did some of that, but I would have done more. This is maybe an applicant advice. So yeah, also apply to Wyoming. I've had a really good experience here, and I'm always happy to talk to people about it if you're considering applying. I guess like, mental health support. I feel like that's something I'd like to talk about. I think it can be a really jarring to go. It's supposed to be the best thing in the world. Like, you're only focusing on your creative work. That's awesome. But it can also feel like the rug just got, like, pulled out from under you in terms of, like, your day-to-day structure. So, you know, even me, I have this really supportive cohort here. I've loved my program. I still had a tough time this summer with, like, some mental health stuff, as I know a lot of people are going through. So, like, don't be afraid to, like, look for resources for that on your campus and talk to people about it and all of that stuff, because you are not alone in that respect. I think it can creep up on you in grad school and we sort of push it aside. So, yeah, that's my other.
Great advice, I think, especially nowadays when there's lots of things that can pile up on us. So thanks for that. And thanks for coming on the show and talking to me. And good luck on finishing the novel, full draft by thesis time.
Yeah, same to you. Thanks for having me.